Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland, and I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we're brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com. A great group of people who understand what it means to be the nation. People who understand that freedom is not only a right, it is a responsibility. And that our freedoms extend only as far as our willingness to take responsibility for our actions and no farther. For all of those folks who are suffering right now in New York and New Jersey and other areas in the Northeast after Hurricane Sandy paid her visit, we send our thoughts and prayers to all of you. I hope those of you who have gotten some power back and who are fans of this show are listening tonight. And I want you to know that all of us at PatriotFamilies.com, all of us who believe that in a disaster we reach out to help one another and not steal from one another, are with you in spirit. We can't be there in person. You will survive and you will rebuild because that's what Americans do. Our topic tonight on Patriot Education, ladies and gentlemen, is memory and learning. I had a question today that arose when I was substitute teaching an eighth grade class in a Spanish 1 course for high school credit. The class had missed 2 days of school because we were on a state of emergency here in Virginia with the onset of Sandy. We were very, very lucky. I, in my own home, did not even lose power. We got a lot of wind. We got a lot of rain. We had some flooding on some of our roads. But in general, we came off very, very lightly. And believe me, I and every other resident of this state, we are all eternally grateful for the only light brush that we got. So this class was told yesterday that they were going to have a test. I have to go into a little background here so you'll understand the parameters. And realize that I'm trying to look at this as objectively as I can. Our Spanish teacher for our school system, we have one, resigned about 3 weeks into the school year. Since that time, we have been unable to fill the position. So, one of our paraprofessionals and me, and I, have been substituting and taking the Spanish class, attempting to give the students their instruction so that they will be able to pass the course and gain advanced high school credit when they are in eighth grade. We have had to fill in. We've had substitutes because the other paraprofessional who was taking the class 4 out of 5 days has left the school system and taken up his calling as a minister. So he is no longer working for us. That leaves me as the only Spanish-speaking staff member who can temporarily teach the course. But I am also responsible for being in charge of the in-school suspension room. So I cannot be in two places at once. I'm wonderful, but not quite good. So we have substitutes come in, and I do not have students in school suspension. I'm asked to go in and teach with the substitute. Well, you add in the fact that we had 2 days of missed school because of the state of emergency for Sandy. So this class of students that I had today was told yesterday that they were going to have a quiz. They were going to have a test. We have to periodically test them to get grade point averages so that we can reckon their grade and decide whether they pass or fail and gain the credit that that will apply to their high school graduation. So it's very necessary that we have a pattern of grading. We have to have so many tests. We have to have so we can get an average and see who's passing and who's failing and who's doing A work and who's doing C work, etc. The test was to cover material that the class had been working on for the last roughly 5 class days. All right, add in addition to the 2 missing days and no regular teacher, the class has this Spanish lesson every other day for approximately 90 minutes. The way our school is structured, our students take their elective courses, music, art, foreign language, computer, etc., the other day, and on the days when they're not in electives, they take physical education, all of them, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. So they get approximately 2 to 3 classes per week of about 90 minutes each for Spanish. Well, we are coming up on the end of the 9 weeks, so we have to send home report cards. So we need grades that can go on the report card. So we were short the test. We had to have one. And it had to be done between now and the 7th of November, because that's the end of the marking period. So yesterday, the students were told that they had a test coming up. The substitute in the class had a set of class exercises that covered the material that was going to be on the test. It was only about describing clothing, knowing the names for shirt, T-shirt, pants, skirt, vest, sweater, the colors, red, green, blue, yellow, how to say I am wearing, a blue shirt, how to understand when you're asked what are you wearing in Spanish. Also, the fact that Spanish adjectives have to match their noun in number and gender and have to come after the noun they modify. All of these things that we have been going over for the last 4 or 5 lessons. Well, today, when I walked in with the substitute to back the substitute up because I wasn't pulled away to do something else, I got what was the equivalent of righteous indignation. That we're having a test and you just told us yesterday and I don't know what this stuff is. And I explained to them that we give tests not because we don't like them, but because we need to be able to measure whether or not they understand the material. And that, I'm sorry, because we had 2 days out for a hurricane, that you didn't hear about this on Monday, but at least you are not standing in the middle of a flood with no power, no gasoline, no car, no emergency rescue vehicles, and wondering whether you're going to eat tonight. Things happen. You were told yesterday, you had classwork to go over it, you had last night to study and prepare. Mutterings and grumblings. So they got the test. I graded the test after they were all finished this afternoon. The 21 students in the class, the 21 students, three got a grade of 70. The rest of them were well below. The highest grade was an 84%. The lowest was a 13%. And guess who got the 13%? The righteously indignant young lady who was complaining so badly about only having overnight to study for a quiz on something they'd been doing for a week. One of my friends in the chat room, Jomer, says, why do they have to learn Spanish when they can just press 1 for English? You're right. They don't necessarily need it if they've got a, you know, touch tone on their cell. But these kids want the credits for high school graduation. One of the students, when I asked a couple of weeks ago why they took the course, told me she wanted to get it over with. She knew that she wanted to take the college prep course and needed a language, so she decided to take Spanish and get it over with so she didn't have to do it when she was in high school. Of course, she also told me that she has a great deal of difficulty remembering anything, which is why I asked her why she was taking the course. So anyhow, with 21 people, grades ranging from a high of 84 to an abysmal low of 13%, I had to talk to our assistant principal and to show him what they had done. I had made up an answer key, and fortunately our assistant principal had some Spanish when he was in high school. And I told him about the grumbling and the complaining and the fact that, what do you mean I have to remember this? You didn't tell me it was on the test. And he looked at it, and he said, this is basic. I said, yes, sir, it is. He said, I'm going to get a lot of phone calls. I said, yes, sir. Unfortunately, our students are somehow or other being taught that whatever it is their teacher is telling them, all they have to do is to get it planted enough that they can spill it out on multiple choice to fill in the blank test with the word bank, and then they can forget they ever heard of it. And it doesn't really show up in most of their regular classes until they hit high school. And they have to pull out a calculator to subtract 5 minus 3 and reliably get 2. But boy, does it show up in foreign language. It shows up as if a glaring spotlight had been placed upon it. The fact that we have 13 and 14-year-old kids, and part of today's lesson after the test was how to tell somebody how old you were. That's how come I know they're 13 and 14. Who have no clue that in order to pass a course in a foreign language, you actually have to remember the vocabulary. My friend Joe says, it was the kid who got the 84%'s fault. They threw off the whole bell curve. He's right, they did. Everything else was basically between 62 and 47. So I have a feeling that there's going to be a retest, or there's going to be a go back and fix it and you get half credit, something. I can kind of understand the indignation, ladies and gentlemen. I understand that for a lot of the kids, some advance notice would have helped them. Yes, it would. It would have been great if I could have been in the class on Friday with these kids and gone over the material personally. But, like I said before, I'm good, but I can't be in two places at once. I was substituting for another teacher. So I could not substitute in Spanish. The class that is going to take this test on Monday, I should be with tomorrow. I will not be with that class on Monday because I have students in the school extension room, so the substitute will end up the test. But the underlying, deeper, more important question, over and above these kids' difficulty with not having enough prep time, their inability to recognize it when you learn a foreign language, the means you actually put it in your brain, keep it there until you die. All of these things are just the surface, just the very tip of the iceberg that's going to sink this country. When our children in public schools believe that they are there to be given a grade, that there is an easy button, well, where they will get a test before they take it as a study guide with all the answers put in, and the next day and spit it back out on fill in the blank with a word bank, and then blithely forget they've ever heard of it before. And learning is fun means that if you're not having fun, you don't have to learn. What is going to happen to these children? What is going to happen to these kids when they get into the real world? How would you like to explain to them, as new hires, what their job is and their responsibilities are? Would you enjoy having to tell them 3 times a day for 2 weeks in hopes that by the third week they might know how to do it? This is what, as an employer or a boss or even a coworker, you are looking at. Looks like I have a call on the line. Hang on, what are you here for tonight? Hello.
Hey, how you doing this morning, or this morning, this afternoon, this evening, and hey, John and everybody else?
Yeah, Michael, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. In listening to what you've said so far, and I hate to interrupt you so early in the show.
That's okay.
But, you know, is it possible, is it very possible that the way that these children are learning, and I'll call them children because it seems that their mindset appears to be in that area, that it's not the fault of the teachers, but it is the fault of their parents?
That's partly it. Yes, you're right about that, Michael. The underlying problem is a combination of several different factors, and no one of them being fixed is going to make the whole thing better. One of the problems is the ridiculous assumption, as I said before, that somehow or other you can accommodate everybody's difficulties and still have them achieve standardized results within a specific time period. So everything is dumbed down to compensate in the collaborative classes for the special ed kids. They get special extra this, that, and the other. And the kids who are average or above are either bored silly or lazy as all get out because everything is given to the SPED kids and you think they're not going to pay any attention? You think they're not going to notice that the SPED kids get the whole exam first and get to study it at home? The second factor among many is that children are no longer expected to memorize anything. When I was in school, we had at least one memorization task every 2 weeks, minimum, sometimes once a week. Anything from memorizing a quotation from Shakespeare or the preamble to the Constitution or the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence or a poem like Joyce Kilmer's Trees or The Highwayman or a Shakespearean sonnet, something, so that we got the memory practice and the memory training. That change is due to the progressive educational theory that rote memorization means the kids don't know anything. They're just repeating, they're not thinking, they're not having fun interactively hands-on learning anything. Well, like every other progressive idea, it throws not only the baby out with the bathwater, it throws the tub away and expects the water to stand in a nice even pool. You cannot learn without memorization. You cannot learn only with memorization. And this is the difficulty. The third problem is parents who expect the school to give their kid a passing grade just because it's their kid. The parents who call up and complain about the teacher not teaching their child right, when the kid never opens a book, never hands in homework, sleeps or acts up during every class, and then gets an F. The teacher isn't teaching right because the teacher is supposed to entertain them so much that they learn by magic. And you're a great one to have us there, Michael. So the parents are a factor, too. And another factor, of course, is the federal interference with education. When you have people up to 3,000 miles away deciding what you should teach in your community to the children of your citizens based on educational theory from a bunch of Marxist, communist, at university professors, is it any wonder that you've got a bunch of kids who can't remember 2 plus 2 equals 4 for longer than 12 seconds and who reach for a calculator quite literally when you add and subtract 5 minus 3? There are other factors as well. The pernicious idea that everybody should get a trophy has spilled over from amateur athletics for fun into the grade book. You can't damage their self-esteem by giving them the F they earned. You can't keep them held back because they can't read, because they'll be so tall they'll stand out among their peers and people will make fun of them. The fact that once they graduate from high school, they're going to be incredibly lucky if they are capable of holding down a job sweeping floors for longer than a week doesn't matter so long as they feel good about themselves. There are so many things, ladies and gentlemen, that contribute to the god-awful mess that our kids and their education are in. As a few moments ago, it's not easy fix. So many different things have to be addressed. We have to look at the philosophy and mindset of dependence that we have grown complacent about and used to over the last 25 to 30 years. The idea that it's government's job to fix everything for me because I shouldn't have to face a risk or be unsafe or fail at anything. That's a factor. The easy button is another factor. We are very, very used to instant gratification. We are incredibly lucky and incredibly wealthy in this nation. We have so many gadgets that do for us practically everything except go to the bathroom and breathe that we have become convinced that somehow or other, we shouldn't have to put forth any actual physical or mental effort to get anything, that it should come dropping as a gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath, as Portia described mercy in The Merchant of Venice. And yeah, I had to memorize that. Another factor, and this is a societal factor, because we are so wealthy, we have, like any parent, believes that it is our job to give our children more than we had. This is not a bad idea at all. This is the inherent aspect of taking on the responsibility for creating another life. If you have children, you want to give them more than you had. It is a built-in biological necessity. But when you go about doing that by trying to have both spouses working full-time so you can get more money to buy more Nintendos and more $150 sneakers and more dancing lessons and Little League and trips and neat clothes and Nintendos and Xboxes and 350-foot plasma TVs for their bedroom because you want to give them things. This is another factor. When you give kids everything they want and they don't have to earn anything, why should they automatically understand that if you want to earn a passing grade, you have to put forth the effort to learn the stuff and remember it? They don't understand why they should have to. It doesn't make any sense to them. Everything else comes immediately. I'll bet you anything you want to name, and I use this line a lot when I'm substituting, that every one of those kids secretly thinks that somehow or other that man or woman in the front of the classroom magically by sheer force of personality or the conferring of a degree, can open up their little brains, stuff knowledge in it against their will, close it back up again, and they go out knowing everything about ancient civilizations of Greece. It's the easy button mentality. The idea that if it isn't easy, well, why should I bother to do it? Somebody needs to make it easy. Somebody needs to give it to me. And there's also, as I said before, the everybody gets a trophy mindset. The idea that alike and equal mean the same thing and competition is bad because if you lose, you feel bad about yourself. And that nobody should be allowed to fail because it damages one's self-esteem. And self-esteem can be given to somebody by telling them how wonderful they are. All of these factors, ladies and gentlemen, come together to create the mess we have in public education. I have so many instances, way more than there's time to relate in a 90-minute radio show, of parents calling the school and demanding a teacher be fired because their child got a B instead of an A because their child didn't follow the directions correctly and it wasn't fair. And the teacher gave them a B because the teacher was jealous that the child was smarter than the teacher was. Oh, yeah, that's a real, real situation, Michael. There was another one, which I've mentioned before on this program, of the lady, African-American lady, who stormed out of the school's main office telling her son, they don't want you to succeed because you're black. When her son was a pathological liar, he cheated, he refused to do the work and then lied about being told he had it to do, and I caught him at it. But, oh, her son was too wonderful to have to abide by anybody's rules. Reminds me, I read a book not too long ago as part of one of the selections for the book club I belong to with some of the teachers at my school. It's called Loving Frank. And it's a fictionalization of a real historical event and personages. It's about the woman who was the mistress of the known architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. And her, it's from her point of view, she and her husband and children to Europe with her lover, Frank Lloyd Wright. His story is very tragic. I won't go into it, ruin it for you if you want to read the book. But it was an interesting book. I learned a great deal about the time period, and I learned a great deal about it that I hadn't known, some that I did know. I learned something new. It was worth reading. But the main thing that I got from that book was a very unpleasant taste in the back of my brain. Frank Lloyd Wright, like many people of great talent, believed, as many progressives of his era believed, that his art and his ability at it freed him from the conventions of the bourgeoisie. That he did not have to abide by the rules of society because he was an artist and so great at what he did that common rules and values could not possibly be expected to apply to him. Kind of reminds me of the clip I've heard from Dreams from My Father of our president saying that he and his buddies squashed their cigarettes out on the carpet of their dormitory as a protest against the petty bourgeoisie. The arrogance is identical. And that's part of the progressive educational theory as well. When you tell a child that somehow or other, he or she at age 13 or 14 is perfectly capable of making any decision he can possibly think of, and being applauded for it, whether it's right or wrong, because he's exercising his freedom and his individuality and building his self-esteem. Is anybody surprised at the teenage wolf who are looting Pony Island? You should be. Because self-esteem does not come as a prerequisite with a ribbon on top for anybody. You can't get it from a store, a teacher, a minister, a mate, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a BFF. About the only one you can get it from is your dog, and he has no clue he's giving it to you. Self-esteem comes from meeting a challenge and doing the best you can to surmount it, even if you fail. That's self-esteem. Not, oh, you spelled K-T-L-W. Isn't that wonderful? The P is so pretty. I'm so proud of you. That's not self-esteem. That's, pardon me, bullshit. I apologize. This is a family show, and I promise I won't say any more crude words. But I don't know any clearer way to express the frustration that all of the good teachers with whom I work feel. I was talking to one of our gym teachers today about the Spanish class and about the fact that they seemed baffled at the idea that they actually had to remember this stuff. And she said one of the reasons that she quit coaching, she was coaching the middle school football team, and they were ahead in a football game. And because everybody gets a trophy and they didn't want to have to work too hard, the defense basically stood around with their heads up their tails, and the other team came back and they had a rousing defeat. And she told the football players, you'd better get your heads out of your asses and start playing football. A parent called and complained she had cursed out her child because she told them the truth. Be not as politely or as politically correctly as the parent would have liked, but they told them the truth. They didn't do their job. They didn't put forward any effort. They were busy looking at birds or something, but they were not playing the game. They didn't follow through on what they had been taught, because everybody gets a trophy. Competition is bad. Believe me, one of them probably said, oh, but the other team would have felt bad if we'd beaten them so badly. I don't think that happened, but it wouldn't surprise me if the parent didn't say that it did. This whole idiotic progressive mindset that has permeated not only our educational system, that was where it started, but through our educational system, our whole society. The parents of my 12, 13, and 14-year-olds generally have been subjected to public education from first grade all the way through high school and college. They're in their 30s, most of them. They are the products of what has been in place for the last 30 years. I know. I watched it happen. I have been involved with education and peripherally with public education since the 1970s. That's 40 years ago. I saw the changes that came in when the Americans with Disabilities Act was modified to include learning disabilities as disability.
Oh, is that another word for saying no child left behind?
You got it, Michael. That's it. The idea that somehow or other, through magic, voodoo, not prayer, of course, because we can't do that anymore, but some sort of esoteric spell that comes into one's head when you graduate with a teaching certificate, is going to make you able to automatically, if you do it right and follow all the progressive ideals, every child in your classroom should wind up with an A. And I'm not kidding you. That's exactly the expectation of teachers today. If they're doing their job right, everybody should get an A.
Terry.
Now, yes, sir.
You know, I have to touch base on a couple things that you said, you know, about, you know, first of all, people do well at things that they enjoy. I know that for a fact. It is much, much easier to remember something when you are doing it if you enjoy what you are doing. And as far as the self-esteem thing, goes, okay? I am not what you call, and I classify these, and I could be wrong, but I classify, learning into two different areas, okay? Either someone is book smart, or they are hands-on smart, okay? And I am not a book smart person, okay? But you can give me a pile of wood, and I will build you the most beautiful piece of furniture you have ever seen in your life from scratch without any knowledge, you know?
Exactly.
And I have done this through my whole life. I have taught myself how to do comedy magic. I have taught myself how to fabricate plastic. I have taught myself this, that. And through that process, okay, I've enjoyed being able to do that and teach myself. So that has automatically built up my self-esteem because I've enjoyed it, because I've accomplished something, and I've succeeded at doing it.
Exactly correct. And this, unfortunately, Michael, this was the only positive thing that came out of Dewey and his love affair with educational theory. He did have one good point, and it was just the point that you made, that people learn in different ways. And roughly they break down into the hands-on learner, the person who needs to touch, see, feel, and smell the material to make it penetrate and stay, and the academic or book-smart learner. And he believed that everybody should have an option so that their learning style would give them what they need. This was brilliant. It was the only good thing he came up with. But instead of saying we need to have both sorts of learning, he threw out book smart and went all into let's have fun and go out and milk a cow. Well, this is grand. This is wonderful for the people who learn that way. But for the ones who are book smart and who learn academically, they're left out in the cold. And the other way of book smart only and no hands-on leaves the craftsman out in the cold. We have to have both. It's the same problem that happens whenever government gets involved in anything to do with real human beings. Government can handle anything that's mechanical. That's input, output, put it in this truck, take it to this point, and unload it. If you give them enough time, they'll get it there. But when it comes to understanding human nature, government cannot. Our founding fathers understood this. That's why they created the Constitution and the branches of government the way they did. Because they did understand that people are just that. They are people. They are not mechanical parts. Our current government cannot and does not understand that. Instead of having everybody should go to college, coupled with Dewey's idea that if you just touchy-feely all the time, you'll automatically learn it, you are creating an impossible oxymoron. A touch learner, okay, a hands-on learner, doesn't belong in college. College, upper university level education, is book smart learner. Doesn't make it better than hands-on craftsman. I've said time and again, I don't want a frickin' poet fixing my washing machine.
Terry, I have a family member who is an excellent book student. Went to 4 years of college down in lower Michigan at a Christian college called Cornerstone. And, when he was in eighth grade, he needed me. He was staying with us for a short time. He needed me to help him for a school project make a funnel. Now, although he has been an A student and he's a math whiz, he has no common sense. He cannot take something real simple and, just put the pieces together. So there is, not saying one is better than the other, but a person really needs to have, a bit of both of these to be a complete, learner.
Functioning, a complete functioning adult, and you are exactly correct. But our kids aren't getting it. They're not getting both. We are directing the ones who are hands-on learners and not book smart off into vocational programs that are nothing but semi-reformatories to get rid of troublesome kids. They don't actually train them to do anything. How many people do you know, Michael, who actually got training enough to get a decent job and support themselves from vocational school instead of regular academic high school?
Well, I was one of those, but that was, you know, 38 years ago as well.
You got it. Do you know any young ones coming out now with training to actually start a job and keep it?
Yeah, nowadays, I mean, it's just not happening.
You're right. That's because in the 1950s, when I started school, okay, I was born in 46, so I started first grade in 1951. At that time, the way that our public education system worked was that it basically tracked the students as to whether they were book learners or hands-on learners. And if they were hands-on learners, they were steered into courses like accounting or secretarial work or shop work or understanding machinery, machine shop, metal shop, all of those things. So they had learned some skills when they got out of high school that they could actually put on a resume. And they could work their way up, and they did. And the book smarts were headed toward college to go into the book smart professions, politics, law, medicine, teaching, those things, okay, which also need some hands-on. I'm not saying it doesn't. And you have to have some book smart in order to be able to balance your checkbook if you're a master carpenter. Both types of learners need some of the other's skills. And it worked really well. But along about the 1960s, everybody got really uptight about how evilly we were pigeonholing these kids who didn't learn the same way and throwing them away on quote-unquote menial jobs. The idiotic idea that somehow or other doing work with your hands is menial and demeaning became part of the culture of academics. It was never the culture of the country. That has never been part of how Americans think. We have always valued craftsmen and hardworking, tough men and women who go out there and get the frickin' job done. My God, that's what got the West settled. That's what got the cities built. That's what put the Transcontinental Railroad across the continent. But the academics in the 60s and forward from there took the idea and made people believe it, made parents of children believe that if their child was a hands-on learner and would have made a damned fine auto mechanic, that that was demeaning to that child and he should be pushed into a path so that he would go to college. Because going to college meant he'd make more money. Because statistics show that those with degrees make more money than those without degrees. Well, statistics, my left hind foot. Mark Twain said, there are liars, damned liars, and statisticians. And in exactly that progression. Yes, people who go to college very often get their entry-level job at a higher rate. But if they can't do it, they're pretty down at the bottom of the heap before the end of their first year of employment, because they don't have the practical knowledge to apply what they have learned. The ones who have both the practical knowledge and the academic knowledge, they're the ones who wind up being CEOs or brilliant surgeons or lawyers or whatever, okay? You've got to have both. But we did exactly what we always do. When somebody comes out with a quote-unquote new idea that they're going to make people better than they ever were before, we jump on the bandwagon and we throw out the baby and the bathtub and expect the water to remain in a pool in the middle of the floor as if the tub were still there. And that is what we have done, Michael. And believe me, I am not an elitist. I do not care one way or the other whether somebody's gone to college or not. If that person is working for me doing a job, is a friend of mine, lives next door, walks down the street, drives my car, fixes my car, teaches my kids, whatever. It's not the piece of paper that said they went to college. It's not the fact that they didn't go. It's what they do that determines their value in my eyes. And that's the basic understanding of what American culture is. We have to stop looking for pie in the sky. We have to stop believing the garbage that comes from progressive throats that says, if we just make enough laws and enough regulations and create enough bureaucracy, we can redesign human beings so that everybody will be identical and everybody will have identical stuff in everybody's houses. And unfortunately, because we have dumbed down an entire generation of Americans, thanks to progressive ideas about education, that's what we've currently got. People who are willing to believe the idiocy that got the current president elected. Because they didn't have to actually learn anything. They were told that what mattered was that they had fun, or that they felt good about themselves, or that the school provided music and art and all the extra bells and whistles and have a beautiful radio station in it and great big TVs and new computers and so on and so forth. The window dressings, the, what is it, $30 billion high school in Los Angeles where something like 4% of the students actually graduate, let alone go on to college. We focused on the wrong things. We always do when we believe that you can redesign people with government. And that has been the underlying root cause from which everything else has sprung in our educational system, in our society, in our understanding of what it means to be a human being and an American. We have bought a sugar-coated poison pill. And we are going to have to pay the price. But we can make that price less heavy if we stop and really look at what we have been doing to our children. And we really do reform. That means remake, change the shape of the way we educate them. We have amazing technology that for the first time in history gives at least a shot at giving everybody the opportunity to learn both the book stuff and the hands-on stuff. We have zillions and zillions and zillions of technological aids that we can use to help kids enjoy the learning experience. Not by singing songs and clapping and going outside to play instead of being in class, but by letting them learn on the computer, letting them play a learning game, interacting in class, having guest speakers in via Skype on the big Promethean board through the internet who can talk to them in Spanish with a Spanish accent because they come from Spain. We are not using the technology that we have for anything other than window dressing. It isn't being effectively employed. Our teachers are not being effectively used. They are babysitters. They are self-esteem builders. They are good buddies and mommies and daddies and counselors and loving puppy dogs. They are not educators or instructors. They are told that they must accommodate every child's individual difficulties and strengths, and still achieve everybody gets an A and everybody passes standardized tests at exactly the same time in their chronological education.
Hey.
My friend, Lynn just said in the chat room that she wants the speakers who came from the old Soviet Union to tell the kids on the big screen why socialism and communism are evil. I'd like that too, Linda. I would really like to have one of the people, like Lech Walesa, speaking live to our civics class, to our eighth graders. I would love that. We could do it. We could. Like the old $6 million man. We have the technology. We can rebuild him. We can do it. But we have to fight teachers' unions, the Department of Education, parents who think that there's magic in a teaching certificate. Their kid doesn't have to do anything except show up semi-clothed and they'll automatically learn. That's part of it, too. We're so concerned about their rights to wear jeans that are three threads held together in strategic places, and it's their freedom of expression that we don't pay attention to the fact that every boy in class is looking at the girl's thighs and not the teacher. Middle school, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, if you've never been in one as an adult, you have no idea how many hormones bounce off the wall at any given moment. And the number of young ladies whose major function in life appears to be practicing for their life as a streetwalker. And you really don't have to learn how to speak Spanish for that, unless, of course, that's where you want to walk the streets. And then you really don't have to say anything to advertise your wares. I'm sorry, that was unkind. But, unfortunately, for some of the young ladies I have seen in various school systems under various situations, that's pretty much the case. I could go into, at least, as I said, there are so many things, so many factors that have combined together to create a perfect storm in education that makes Sandy look like a mild summer breeze. The devastation that we see from Sandy in New Jersey and New York is easy to understand. It's visible. It's tactile. We can smell the sewage backing up in the basements of houses. We can see the rat problem increasing in the subway tunnels as the rats run away from the floods. We know, because we have experienced it, many of us here on the East Coast before, what it's like to sit in your house with no heat and no light and no refrigeration and no gas station that has gas, or if they do, they can't pump it. These are real things to us. My friend says we need displaced rats in D.C. I was kind of hoping Sandy would do it for us, but she hit New York and New Jersey instead. I do find it kind of interesting that those are very much Democratic states, ladies and gentlemen. Makes me wonder a bit. But then again, I cannot claim, and I will not claim, to understand the mind of God. I can just sort of smile when I think I get a glimmer. But Sandy is real and visible and understandable because it's something that we can almost reach out and touch. But we can't and don't see the effects of Hurricane Sandy-type education until we hit the point where we are a third-world country. If you want devastation, think about that. Because what we are doing in educating our children will create economically, financially, and globally kind of devastation that, as I said, makes Sandy look like a summer breeze. If we do not stand for the principles upon which this nation was founded, including the understanding that you cannot make life risk-free and no one can be guaranteed perfect safety, if we don't live our lives proclaiming these things, then we will have a global Hurricane Sandy when it comes to this nation and its ability to even feed and clothe itself, let alone be a pillar and a beacon of freedom to the rest of the world. I get frustrated, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm passionate about what I do. I admit it. I'm not ashamed of it. It's part of who I am. Because I am close to the system, and because I see the flaws so glaringly, as I did today with those kids who were absolutely astonished that they were expected to remember anything and be tested on it, almost throw up my hands in despair. I don't quite get there, though, because I do have belief in and hope for this nation of ours and the people who live in it, work in it, and love it. We know what our roots are. All of us. No matter how loudly we may whine and complain and curse and rant and rave and jump up and down and scream and throw things at televisions. We do understand that it always comes back to us. That it comes back to the individual. Not the individual doing anything he wants, regardless of consequences, because he's too good to have to abide by anybody else's rules. Not the Frank Lloyd Wright, a genius, law doesn't apply to me. Not that kind of individual. Not the individual whose rights supersede yours. And I can do what I want, but you're not allowed to do anything that I don't like or that may potentially offend me. Not that individual. We are the individuals who understand that my freedoms extend only to your front door. They do not extend into your living room, or your church, or your bedroom, or your kitchen. Those are yours. And your rights and freedoms are sacrosanct there. We are the kind of individuals who believe in the truth of the quote, I may disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. We are the individuals who may think a video mocking Islam is stupid, illogical, and silly, but we are the individuals who don't go out and burn something down or kill somebody when someone makes a video mocking our particular religion, whatever it is. We are the individuals who understand it's not my job, man. It's one of the first stepping stones on the way to hell. We are the individuals who understand if we bring children into this world, we are responsible for those children. Our job as parents is to teach them, to love them, to protect them from unnecessary risk, to care for their bodies and their minds and their spirits in whatever way we believe will help them to be everything they have the potential to become. We're those kind of individuals. We're the kind of individuals who go to the PTA meetings even if we don't have a kid in school. You don't have to have a child in a school system to belong to the PTA, or PTO, as they call it in our county. It's a huge expense. I think it costs $15 a year to belong. You know, I can take stuff to a recycling bin and get $15 for the PTA. We're the kind of individuals who go out and walk the streets of California to oppose Agenda 21 and its total desire to rip away private property rights, like my friend Linda. We're the kind of individuals like my friend Michael, who does a radio show on Blog Talk every week, to try to help people understand and see the truth behind the lies. We're the kind of people who listen and learn, and we're the kind of people who remember. That's right. We know that memory is a part of learning. We know that memorizing, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is not just an exercise in saying words, but a creed by which we must live. We don't memorize the words to get a grade. We memorize them because they mean something to us. We understand that knowledge is of value for its own sake. For without knowledge, we cannot govern ourselves as individuals or as a nation. We remember a time when we looked to the press to tell us the truth about those in power and expose double dealing and chicanery and lies, because that was the reason freedom of the press was in the First Amendment to the Constitution. We remember. Have a caller. Hang on, folks. We'll see who's on the line. Hello there.
Linda here.
Hi, Carolyn.
Can you hear me? I was phone banking again. We're doing our last push for our local people, and it's been pretty crazy, so I get tired, but I sleep a lot, and I did a 90-minute show yesterday on Agenda 21. It was wonderful. I had a great chat room. I had like four or five callers, including Mr. Bill Strong and Michael, and it was just amazing. So, and I'll continue to do those pieces as often as possible, because you're right, it is an anti-property rights situation, and that was one of the main tenets of our founding fathers, because they knew that that only lords and kings could have property and everybody else was SOL.
They
hated that. Huge. So everything that these clowns at the UN Agenda 21 crowd from the Earth Summit and all this stuff at Rio, what they do is they're using communism to foment this new religion or the new world order. And I'm telling you, because every time I let people read the things that I've got, you know, in my little meetings, and they're unaware of it because I'm trying to educate folks. And this one gal, she looks at me and she says, she read the first page or page and a half. She says, this is communism. And I go, yes, it is.
That's right. That's what it is.
Recognizing it. And, I mean, it's so clear once you've got even a smattering of history, my Lord, you don't need 10 books. You only need two or three good ones.
Well, you and I remember, we literally remember, Linda, what communism was. We remember what it did to the people of China and the people of the Soviet Union. We remember Stalin. We remember Mao Zedong. We remember women with little babies with hand grenades in the baby's diaper in Vietnam. We remember those things. We not only were living at the time, but we remembered what we learned and what we saw. Memory. Passed down from one generation to the next. It comes back to the old saw of those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And this is the other aspect of tonight's topic on the show tonight. Our kids are not being taught to remember these things.
I know. It's horrible.
And what have we to give them other than our knowledge and our memories? What happens when the last participant in World War II, the last American soldier, sailor, Marine, is no longer here.
Right. I know. This is why it was so important to the Native American Indians to listen to their elders, because they sat for hours telling stories and probably didn't divert from any of the old ways. Probably every jot and every tittle was remembered. And this is how they taught their children, and it was carried on for generations upon generations. This is, we could take a page out of their book, I'll tell you.
Exactly. And you know, the bad part, bless their hearts, most primitive people without written language, which the Indians didn't have, American Indians didn't have, nor did any other cultures in the rest of the world hundreds of thousands of years ago. Oral tradition and oral history was how you kept your society and your culture intact. We have it so easy. We have written history. It's all there. We don't even teach our kids to read.
I know.
Bar them from getting at the stuff. We condense it and water it down, and we limit their knowledge of the Constitution to the preamble, and half of them don't even know what the words mean.
No. And it's being hidden from them, and I do believe it's on purpose. I think they've erased so much. And it's an evil conspiracy.
And it's
tinfoil hat.
it is Dr. Death in the garb of a politically correct angel.
Exactly.
Because that's what's done it. We can't criticize anybody because it will make them feel bad. They'll be offended. Right. Well, tough cookies, honey. Nobody gives a rat's behind if they offend me by telling me I should be a happy little communist and shut up. They think it's okay. And I have something I want to put out on the air. My husband just gave me a little note. Hang on a second. Don't go away, Linda.
Go ahead.
I got an email from a friend. I'm not sure how accurate it is, but I'm going to put it out there because it can be researched. Apparently, on The Tonight Show years ago, Johnny Carson was interviewing Lee Marvin. For those of you who are old enough to remember Lee Marvin, the actor, okay, Johnny was asking him about his service in World War II. And he said to Lee Marvin, I understand you are a Marine and were decorated for your actions at Iwo Jima. And Lee Marvin said, it was more bad management, bad luck, got myself shot in the butt. But there really was a hero that day. It was my sergeant. And that guy, he deserved more than I did. He stood there on that beach we landed. And he stood there taking fire until he was sure all his men were secured and they could move forward. That man deserves the highest award that anybody can think of. Sergeant Keeshan was one hell of a man. When I came down off that mountain on the litter, he stopped beside me and asked me how I was doing, and he handed me a cigarette. And he said, well, how's it going, Lee? And I said, well, tell Mom when I get home that she's going to have to get rid of the outhouse. That man, Sergeant Keeshan, is known to most people as Captain Kangaroo.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Huh?
That's amazing.
Yep. Do you remember Mr. Rogers, that soft-spoken fella in the sweater with the pockets?
Yeah.
Mr. Rogers was an Army Ranger Special Forces. Uh-huh. Had more than 20 kills to his name.
My goodness.
25 kills. He was a master in unarmed combat and taught it in his career in the Army.
Wow.
After the war, he went into the ministry and vowed that he would follow the teachings of Jesus and never harm anyone again.
Wow. Amazing.
Yep. None of the three of those men ever said a word publicly about their heroism. Not one of them. They remembered, and that was enough.
Oh, yeah. You can't forget that kind of stuff.
Nope. But things like that, Linda, things like that are what we should be teaching our kids. Those are the kind of men you look up to. Not a pretty boy who gives a great speech and shoots hoops with the neighborhood boys.
Oh, I know. You know, when you talk about the revisionist history and they're not getting it, I mean, as you said, the books are there. If I can get them, anyone can get them. They haven't burned them yet.
No, they have not.
I still fault the parents for not looking into these things. If they want their kids educated, then they should demand it.
But so many of them, huh? Parents who are in up through high school right now, they're product of the same system.
Yes.
They weren't taught it either. I'll give you an example. David and I, my husband and I, were talking earlier. I was venting at the Spanish class and the fact that, you know, it's awfully difficult to explore things like definite and definite and indefinite articles in Spanish when they don't know what the words mean. Describe those things in English. They have no clue that what a definite article is or an indefinite article or what an adjective is. So when you tell them adjectives come after the noun and they agree in number and gender, they look at you and say, huh. But anyhow, David was talking about one of his few academic triumphs. Being dyslexic, academic triumphs were hard for him. He was sitting and he was bored silly in his English class, and the teacher ranted and raved that he needed to pay attention because this was important stuff that they were learning about how to diagram sentences, and he already knew how. So the teacher challenged him. He was going to humiliate him. So he had him come up to the board and told him to diagram the preamble to the Constitution. He did it. He had it memorized, and he diagrammed it perfectly. He knew.
Awesome.
Even dyslexic. for God's sake. He learned this stuff because it was taught to him.
Right.
You know, I was taught to diagram sentences. I was taught what adjectives and adverbs and participles and prepositions and pronouns were.
Mm-hmm.
How do you teach anybody a foreign language and explain to them the way the words go together if you can't tell them in English that this is a preposition, this is a pronoun, and it's first person singular, when they don't know what a pronoun is and they have no clue what first person means? I went through it too. Yes. And these kids, the other thing that's crazy, what qualifies them for the opportunity to take a credit course in eighth grade is their above average scores on the English standards of learning.
Oh, my Lord.
The SOLs don't question you about grammar anymore. It's all reading comprehension.
That's wow.
Handy. I'm glad you comprehend English when you read it. But if you don't know what I mean when I tell you that the stem of the infinitive is this, because you don't know what an infinitive is, how in the name of all that's holy are you taking a course that's supposed to give you high school credit? And if you can't remember things, why are you in this class?
I know. It's craziness.
As I've said before, there are a lot of different factors, Linda, that all play into this. A lot of it has to do with the craziness of the 60s and the make love, not war mm-hmm. generation. It has to do with the civil rights movement and the ridiculous compensatory moves made by government. Instead of just mm-hmm. saying, okay, give it a shot, it's, oh, we have to help you because you're innately stupid and you'll never get anywhere unless we make it easy for you, which automatically tells people, you know, you're stupid, so don't bother to try. We'll give it to you. Yeah, that's part of it, the desegregation and the whole idea that we lower the standards so the black kids coming into the white schools will still get good grades and they won't feel bad about themselves, the good old self-esteem thing again. All of these things that, like many roads to hell, were paved with the very best of intentions and had exactly the unintended consequences that, if you had a half a grain of sense, would have been quite clear.
Exactly.
And it's all
coming
together now.
Yeah, well, we've come to see with any time the federal government, even a state government, starts meddling in places they have no damn business being in, then you result. And so, mm-hmm. and show me the government that was limited like our first original republic was, mm-hmm. that ever became tyrannical. It didn't happen.
No.
It had to be a giant machine. That's what they're fomenting now. They've been doing it for 80 years or better, and it's terrifying.
That's the way they think. They cannot think outside the machine mindset.
I know.
It kind of makes you think that we are living in iRobot by Asimov, and that everybody's been replaced by, you know, the three laws of robotics, and they left out the first one, if you're familiar with the series. But it's the culmination of a lot of ideas and a lot of attempts to try to make things quote-unquote fair and quote-unquote level the playing field that wound up doing the exact opposite of what they were intended.
I know, and the only reason that we still have a shred of a republic left and that we have some of our freedoms and that the government fears us pretty
mm-hmm.
much all the time is because we still have our arms and our ammunition, and I'll never give that up.
and nobody, Linda, nobody wants to come out and say the truth and give the real reason why that's there. That is there to protect us against tyrannical government.
Absolutely. Oh, I'll say it.
Yep. Me too, honey. I'll say it loud and clear. The Second Amendment protects you from your government.
You bet. And they know it.
Uh-huh. For the same reason that Japan had no intentions of ever attempting to invade the continental U.S. Because Americans have guns and they know how to use them.
Yeah, behind every blade of grass, you betcha.
It was the same reason that Hitler's evil attempts to invade Britain didn't work. Because they used to have guns. And
mm-hmm.
that's why Switzerland is as rich and as powerful as it is now. Because everybody has a freaking gun. By law, you have to have one of your
own. I know. And they're well-trained in them as well.
Yes, they are. People on the left will do or say anything, case in point, our president over Benghazi, in order to bolster their own power and to reassure the nervous public that we'll be right there and everything will be fine. I don't know whether you you watched Glenn's show tonight and heard did you see the article in his radio show on Blaze with the photographs from his director of Mercury One in Kona?
I'm not sure if I've seen all the stuff on the Blaze today because I was busy doing emails and I did watch Glenn's show. But
if you
are
exhausted,
which one?
Go on to the Blaze and look at the article on what Mercury One, his charitable organization, when they went to Coney Island, what they found.
Okay, I'll check it out. Okay.
Yeah, it's on the Blaze and it's well worth reading. But that's
and what
an
I
example.
I did like Glenn's little thing. He says, "Guess how I translate lean forward? Bend over."
Bend over, honey. Yeah. Oh, look, I do one. Yeah, pretty much. And that basically is, you know, Agenda 21. And
God.
A lot of the other wonderful level the playing field, make everybody feel good, politically correct, don't offend anybody, I guess.
Sure.
Like our idiot Secretary of State applauding the idea of making anybody who says anything remotely offensive to a Muslim about the incredibly wonderful Muhammad a crime, a global crime.
And she, you know where she can put that?
Sideways.
I'm going to let you wind it up, and thank you for taking my call, and I'm going to go back to the chat room. God bless everyone.
It's always a pleasure, Linda. Thanks for calling in tonight. Keep up the good work, sweetheart.
I am, sweetie. Thanks. Bye.
You're welcome. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have about, maybe 13 minutes left of tonight's show. And thank you for your patience in listening to me rant and being passionate about what I do and what I see in what I do that mirrors the trouble we're in nationally and globally. My focus, necessarily, is very much on education because that's my job. It's also my calling, if you will. I kind of have to be a teacher. It seems to me that I was programmed that way by whoever or whatever we call God. When I came onto this earth, I was destined to teach somebody something. And I can no more stop doing that than I can voluntarily stop reading for longer than about 30 seconds. But because education of our children is what creates the climate for our youth, I believe what's going on in education must have a bright light shown upon it. Because that bright light was not shown upon it 30 years ago when all of this began. And because it was not shown upon it as clearly and honestly and ruthlessly as it should have been, we are in the position we are now with our government, with our status in the world, with our economy, and with our society. I am not a reactionary. I do not want to go back to 1722 and own 6 black slaves. No, I don't want to own any slaves. I have enough trouble living with cats. I do not want to be responsible for anybody else. I do not want to go back to a time when there were no window screens or air conditioning or antibiotics. I have no desire to live in the Middle Ages and only bathe twice in my life. I do not want to eat with a knife and a piece of bread to hold my food. I do not want to spend 18 days going from Philadelphia to Boston. I like the comforts of civilization. I love the explosion of technological expertise that allows me to wash clothes in one day without having to haul water from the river, heat it on a wood stove for which I had to chop the wood, and clean up the mess afterwards. I like modern times. I like the quote-unquote easy button when it is applied to those things for which it was designed. I do not like the idea, the mantra, the spell that says, oh, well, technology and government are so wonderful that we can remake people so they'll all always do the right thing. No, we can't. I am not a defeatist. I do not believe that people are innately horrible and that we're all going to have to barricade ourselves in our homes and shoot every stranger we see. I believe that people can live together. They can be in a society. We are gregarious as a species. We are, in a sense, akin to the wolves in their pack. We depend on one another. We help one another. We protect one another. We supply things to one another. We use our skills in ways to benefit ourselves and those with whom we share society. We have a social contract that if we live in a community, there are certain things that we do and do not do so that the community can thrive and flourish and continue. But those things do not include everybody wearing the same dress or pants, everybody saying the same words at the same time, everybody eating the same thing for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, everybody weighing the same amount, everybody being exactly the same height, everyone having identical interests, everyone having equal and identical stuff. We are human. You are not going to get that, and God forbid you ever should. That is not what being human is about. Being human is understanding that we have the potential for greatness in both evil and good. And using self-discipline and family and community and spiritual beliefs and the basic understanding that if I don't help you when you're in trouble, you won't help me when I'm there. We can be better than the lowest part of ourselves. We can make progress, real progress, not progressive progress that promises us an impossible utopia full of clones wearing gray with no facial expression because they don't think. That is not utopia. That is not heaven on earth. That is about as close to hell as I ever want to come. We cannot, will not, and should not ever believe that we can, quote-unquote, level the playing field so everybody crosses the finish line at exactly the same time. It does not happen. We can offer opportunity, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we were founded on. That's why the people came here from all over the world and brought their culture and their traditions and words from their language and their foods and their spiritual beliefs. They came here because they had an opportunity to be something more than what they could be back home. Not to have more than everybody else in the place, or to impose their home culture on ours, or to redesign our country so they remade what it was that they came from. They came here to be free. Not free from responsibility. Not that at all. Because loading you and your wife and your 18 children and great-grandmother on the boat in steerage to cross a big cold ocean to land in New York where you didn't speak a word of the language, believe me, that was a big responsibility, and they took it. It wasn't to be free of rules. No, they knew there were rules. Many of them didn't get in because of the rules we had about who we would let in and who we would not. They knew this. And those who did were thankful, and those who didn't were heartbroken. But they didn't hate us for it. They still wanted to come in. Because here the freedom was not freedom from responsibility or freedom from law or freedom from criticism or freedom from any other kind of thing. It was freedom for opportunity. Just that. Freedom for opportunity. That is what we need to teach our children. Whether they're hands-on learners like my friend Michael, Or my husband David, for that matter. Or my great-son David. Or book smart, book learners like me. Or my sister Elizabeth. Or my dad. Or a lot of the kids that I teach. There was opportunity for everyone who came here willing to put forth effort. And the people who came here understood that. They didn't come here expecting to be taken care of or given anything except that opportunity. They loved the fact that instead of their children never learning to read because they were doomed to be a peasant tilling the fields until they dropped dead, here their kid could go to school and become a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or a nurse. They could. Nobody cared that their child was a child of parents who were serfs or country folk or not noble or not wealthy. Nobody cared. Their kid could learn in the same classroom with a millionaire's son, if that millionaire's son happened to go to public school. That was why they came here, and that's what our educational system is supposed to be. Not babysitters, not feel-good backpatters and burpers, guardians to keep our children mentally retarded to the age of 13 until they get government school. It was the opportunity to learn and be more than you were yesterday. We can change things, ladies and gentlemen, and I believe that we will. Simply because that's what Americans do. If we don't like the way it is, we do something to change it. If we don't like the stones in the field that we're living on right now, we pick up the wife and kids, put them in a wagon, and go west and find some other field that doesn't have any rocks in it. That spirit, that genetic inheritance, is part of all of us. Even the Native American peoples came here by the land bridge from Siberia. They were looking for an opportunity, too. And that's what we have to give our kids. Not a guaranteed grade because the teacher likes me. Not a, I'll remember it for the test and then I don't have to remember it anymore. Not a complaint and a whine because the worst thing that happened to you all week was the fact that you only had one day's preparation for a test when people in Coney Island are barricading themselves in their houses because wolf pack gangs of teenagers are looting everything. Yeah, you had 2 days at home with power and your Xbox, and now you're crying because you didn't use them to actually learn what you've been going over for the last week, and it's not fair. I give you a test. I don't expect 13 and 14-year-olds to have the life experience to be able to understand that somebody else is always worse off than you are. It's endemic to being a teenager. Nobody else has ever suffered than you are. I expect this from them. But not expect, nor will I tolerate, continuing to tell children that they do not have to do anything to achieve a goal. Please join us, ladies and gentlemen, next week here on Blog Talk for Patriot Education. Visit our website, talk with our members, read some of our blogs, follow some of the links. Find out a way that you can stand up and speak for what you believe. Talk to your neighbors, your family. Let them know that you are not going to buy the poison pill with the sugar coating, that you understand the principles on which this nation was founded, and you will literally defend to the death the right to disagree. Stand on your feet, ladies and gentlemen, because you are the nation. Join us every night of the week for a show on Blog Talk Radio. Sundays, Frank is Fed Up. Monday, Constitution Hour. Tuesday, Patriot Family Chat. Wednesday, Right from the Left Coast. Thursday, Patriot Education. Friday, Foreclosure Help. And Saturday, Breaking the Illusion. We have something for everybody out there, ladies and gentlemen. Come and share with us your ideas, your concerns, your vision for the future of this wonderful nation we call home. You are the nation. If we cannot rule ourselves as individuals, we cannot rule ourselves as a people. Good night, everyone, and God bless.
Outstanding, Governor.
Thank you, sweetie.